Hey, everyone. This is the live show from last Thursday, the Thanksgiving show. Kind of a silly one, but also some interesting stories. And I will just say this. First of all, the story is not as cohesive as it could be, because remember, when we're live, we have to take a break every 10 minutes. But I've edited it to be as smooth as possible. And also, gosh, you know, sometimes when I tell these history stories, I listen back to them and I say, oh, a little too absolute with my language there. I'm actually working on another podcast right now where I talk about this. And from a critical thinking standpoint, I've told a lot of young people that you can often judge errors in argumentation by a rhetorician's use of absolute language, right? What's that old saying? There are no absolutes. That's a stolen concept fallacy right there, by the way. But yeah, I'm talking about the Pilgrims, and I'm kind of painting this picture as if this Native American named Squanto is just standing there absolutely by himself when the Pilgrims show up, that he is like Will Smith, I Am Legend kind of situation. And that's not the truth. And I just caught myself several times listening back to this recording, painting that picture with some of the language that I was using. So I want to point out that that was not the case. There were other people there, but the population had been greatly, greatly reduced, and we're going to get into all of that by the time the Pilgrims arrive, but we're going to get into all of that during the actual show today. And yeah, go on Reddit and read comments. I did this recently, and it will really make you more aware, make you more careful about not sounding like a know-it-all. I think that's something that I need to do before I'm going to talk about history on this show, because I sound like one of those Reddit commenters at some points of this. So I apologize for that, and I hope you enjoy this story. I will also, at the very end, this is optional listening, I'm going to attach about a 20-minute segment from our after show where we continued this discussion. That is an adult-oriented show with strong language, with adult themes. So you will have the option. It will be very clearly differentiated from the regular show. So you can stop there if you want. You've got, you know, better things to do than listen to me cuss and giggle with Osborne. All right, here you go. Hey, everybody, this is Brett, and welcome back to School Sucks Live. Osborne, who's in the studio with me tonight.
Hey, man.
How you doing?
I am thankful.
Yeah, it's Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that's right. It's that day.
Did you have a good one?
It was good and not so good all at the same time.
I would say I had the best one that I've had in many years.
I will say, food-wise, this was the best one I've ever had. We made a turkey and some sweet potatoes, and that was it.
We had turkey as well, and some sweet potatoes.
Nice.
And some beef.
Ah, beef.
Yeah, that's sitting in my car. I got some leftovers. There was some pies. I sampled the pies. I'm not supposed to eat pie, but okay. I had a little bit.
We did have some paleo pumpkin pies that have been around for the last couple of days, but I didn't really dig into them.
And it was very placid. I didn't start any trouble. I wanted to interview people about, we were going to talk about the appeal to tradition, which is a logical fallacy. Mm. We're going to take the show in a slightly different direction, but I wanted to interview all of the olds in my family about what does it mean? What is tradition? What is the importance or the value of tradition? Mm. But I didn't. Instead, here's four holidays that I'll ruin for people every year. Christmas, that's an easy one. Mm. You know, you bring up Saturnalia, the pagan festival that existed before. 4th of July, that's a super easy one to ruin. You know, I'm talking about get-togethers, because I can ruin Memorial Day. I can ruin Veterans Day.
Valentine's Day.
I could ruin Valentine's Day. But my big four to ruin, Christmas, 4th of July, Easter, and of course, Thanksgiving. But I kept my lips, not sealed, but certainly off that subject. And we had a very wonderful family time.
Wow.
Small gathering, you know, my mom, my brothers, their kids, my uncle. But this is an important day, and I actually kind of look fondly back at this day.
Already you're looking fondly back.
Well, this year was a momentous one because I shot my first turkey yesterday.
Oh, you didn't even tell me this.
I did.
Oh, my goodness. Do tell.
Well, boy, it scared the crap out of everyone else in the frozen food section.
You, sir, should not be allowed to handle firearms.
Yeah, that's going to be our theme song when I tell a Thanksgiving-related
poster
joke
tonight. Child for the Brady Bill.
Yeah. Did you hear that?
Hear what?
This. Uh-oh, it's Thanksgiving. We are going to have a good time. That is going to be
Friday,
the song.
No.
That is
different.
Different. Different girl, similar disastrous ending right at the beginning of a career.
Right.
But that's going to be the song whenever I tell a Thanksgiving-related joke on the show tonight. That's
oh, good. Thanksgiving theme song.
Did you ever see Bernie Mac on Def Comedy Jam when he came out? Like, every comedian at the thing was bombing, right? You remember Def Comedy Jam? It was hosted by Martin Lawrence. It was a tough
I've heard of it. I never, right. Yeah.
So Bernie Mac comes out. He's an unknown comedian. He's wearing a ridiculous outfit. He looks like a juice box or something, like a children's candy.
Oh, what's his style?
Gets on the stage, right, with those, you know, he had that scary look, if you can picture Bernie Mac, in this ridiculous outfit, like some kind of clown gone mad. And he said, "I ain't scared of you MFers," right, and stared the crowd down. And then he would start telling jokes, and he would punctuate his jokes. After every joke that he told, he would say, he would make the DJ play music, and he would dance. And then he would tell the DJ to cut the music, and he would say, "I ain't scared of you." And he would do it after all the other comedians. It's like one of the greatest comedy performances ever. So in tribute to Bernie Mac, he's dead, right?
Right, he is.
Yeah. Well, every time I tell a Thanksgiving-related joke tonight, you're going to hear that song by Nicole Westbrook. It's called It's Thanksgiving.
All right.
I didn't shoot a turkey yesterday. Thanksgiving is special to me for other reasons. And we talked a little bit about this before the show, and I think you actually had a similar story to tell. It was the story of Thanksgiving I learned when I was in college that really ignited my interest in history, which for so many years, at least all through middle school and high school, had been my absolute least favorite subject. I couldn't stand history. I thought it was so boring.
I as well, yes.
But when you get to college, now there's pitfalls of learning about stuff in college too, as we've talked about on the show and you certainly experienced. But I remember this shock of like how much more there was to this story than just some dumb fairy tale they tell you in second grade.
Yeah. Well, see, I think history is that subject that is so easy for college professors to suck students in and warp their minds.
Why is that?
Because unlike any other subject, history throughout all of pre-college education is just the here's these dates and these names, and you just learn these things. But as soon as you get to college, now there's all this spin that goes on, and the professors mold these stories of histories to fit their own particular ideology.
So they can tell you stuff that's almost 100% true. And I believe that, you know, the research of people like James Lowen, who wrote The Lies My Teacher Told Me, Howard Zinn, who was a big influence on me, he wrote The People's History of the United States, and my history professor, most of what they said was true. Maybe almost all of what they said was this fresh, wonderful, exciting perspective about what had really happened to ordinary people in the past, erased from history, from this fairy tale version that we get in government school. But they can just tweak it, as you're saying, right? Just a little bit to package or like kind of put their agenda into it and send it along to you. And it worked on me.
Mm-hmm.
I was a socialist when I graduated from college.
Yes.
Yeah. And I have a prop here on the show if you're watching us on video. I'm holding up this binder, right? And you can see that it's falling apart.
Is it a binder full of women?
Ramney. No, this is actually the binder that I assembled. And I'm going to open it. I hope this isn't too distracting for the audio people. But I'm flipping through. All of these are handwritten notes that I took. You can see it's highlighted in some spots. This is the binder that I used when I taught American history in a private school. And I picked it up the other day because I knew Thanksgiving was coming. And I said, you know, no matter what we wind up doing the show about, it would be nice to have like a few here and there's about the old Thanksgiving. So maybe I'll go and I'll see what I had. I'll see what I used to tell kids.
Oh.
Maybe we'd even find something funny. Like I used to say something ridiculous. And I'm sure there's plenty of examples of that in that binder. Like things I totally wouldn't stand by anymore when I was still stuck under the spell of the, you know, left-wing presentation of history and economics that so many of us get in college. But Now, I stumbled across a story, and I can tell that my teacher, who was a young guy when I had him, was influenced by Zen, was influenced by that Lies My Teacher Told Me book. And I looked at my notes, and then I had this kind of, I was at my brother's, and I had this thought. I wonder what his two kids, one's 13, so he's in seventh grade, and one is six, so she is in first grade. What if I go and interview them? Just, you know, not on the record, but just casually about like, hey, you know, what do you cover in school about Thanksgiving? What they told me was interesting, and it kind of fits this thesis that I had put forward much earlier in School Sucks podcast that we are going to talk about in just a couple minutes. If you're just joining us, we were talking about the truth of this holiday. It's a story that few people know, and I'd like to share it with you now.
Lay the truth on us, Brent.
I was surprised to learn this because it sounded like such a fantastical story. But by the time the first Thanksgiving came at the beginning of the 1620s, there was a considerable amount of tension and strife between the pilgrims and the natives already. And a group of them had gotten together to do like one of these, are you familiar with super groups? They were big in the 80s. And I'm not talking about a super group like, is Rush considered a super group?
Maybe.
Like Rush is a power trio.
Sure.
I'm thinking of like where people would come together, like Farm Aid. The one they did? We Are the World, where they put all these people together. Sure. But
so you're not talking about like Chickenfoot.
No. This is the first example of a bunch of people from different backgrounds coming together to try and deal with social issue in a constructive and musical way.
Right.
So the natives and the pilgrims decide to form a band similar to what we saw, I think, at the very beginning of the 90s when the East Coast rappers and the West Coast rappers got together and did We're All in the Same Gang.
Gotcha.
Right.
Okay.
So this process gets going. At the time, the industry was a lot less muddied with like contracts and agents, so they could get right to work. And a turkey comes up to their rehearsal.
Like an animal, turkey, a bird.
Yeah, because sometimes, you know, you would say, hey, you turkey.
Right.
But this is a turkey.
Like and a literal turkey, with feathers. And
yeah.
Okay.
So the turkey comes up and he sees what's going on. And he says, hey, can I be in your band?
The turkey talked.
Yeah. He says, hey, can I be in your band?
Okay. So this is like biblical times when like animals talk to people and stuff.
This is 1620, my friend.
Okay. So it was like a leftover from, okay.
This is, and if you're listening to this, listen, we are going to tell real stories. The turkey says, hey, can I be your band?
So this is not true.
What? No, we are going to tell more real stories.
Okay.
After
more
this
real
one
stories. Okay.
About this pilgrim period, about the settling. And if you're only listening to us, I'm using air quotes for the word settling because a lot of what we're going to hear tonight is very unsettling. But the Indians and the pilgrims, they both say, no, you're a turkey. You're an idiot. He says, I want to make more friends than are people. The turkey says, all my friends are turkeys. So they're looking at the turkey like you're looking at me. Let's just have a look at how you're looking at me. You've kind of squinted your eyes. Where are you going with this? They say, no, you're an idiot. You're a turkey. You don't even have any hands. Right.
Right.
And the turkey says,
oh, I know what he's got.
But I've got drumsticks!
Oh.
That's our theme song that goes along with Thanksgiving-related jokes tonight. But that is an accidental joke. That's part of the story.
Okay.
The turkey, finally, they say, look, we'll give you an audition. But the turkey is such an annoyance that eventually they make a very high-stakes wager with the turkey. Remember, this is, if you're just joining us, this is the origin story of Thanksgiving. They say, we are going to sit you at the drums, you dumb bird, and if you can keep the rhythm to this song, you can be in our super group to help settle these social friction through music. Right? I don't see why you want to be involved in this. You're not a Native American, you're not a pilgrim, you're not even a part of this. You're a friggin' bird. So if you win, if you can keep the rhythm, you're in. If you lose, we get to kill you, cook you, and eat you. And none of your kind may ever utter another word for the rest of time.
Wow.
Yeah. And then they played a song, you know, that the turkey couldn't keep a rhythm to. And the rest is history, as they say.
How did they cook a turkey back then? They didn't have ovens or...
Way that at least a few people walk away from the engagement with salmonella.
I would say.
You know, the Native Americans knew what they were doing. They would know how to cook something like that.
You think they would? Yes.
Yeah. And it's questionable as to whether or not there was even turkey there. My story, listen, if you're new to, like, if you're just, like,
it seems like
dipping your toes into the study of history, the story I just told was not true. I made it up during the break. So, but we are told some pretty ridiculous stories about this event, this first Thanksgiving. And what it hides is so unfortunate, not just in what it conceals about the truth, but also in the opportunities that are missed. In the last segment, we were talking about the shock of college, I guess we could call it, right, Osborne? How we, you know, we go to college and we have these history professors and we suddenly are privy to this whole new story that's exciting and has drama and has things that we just didn't hear in school because it was controversial. So what's absent from the presentation of just about everything historical when we are in our 15,000 hours of government school and whatever portion of those hours are spent in some kind of history class is the existence of controversy. There's no need for us to do inquiry because history is just another textbook. Like math or science, everything that there is to know is already known, and all you have to do is sit here and read and take a test, and then you can know it too. And I had mentioned that I was having this informal conversation with my nephew and my niece, and I asked them about it. I said, you know, what do you learn about Thanksgiving at school? My niece is six. She didn't know anything. Like, didn't even really, what, like, she wasn't even given the myth. But then when I asked my nephew, who was 13, he said, well, we used to talk about it a lot when I was like in first and second and third grade, but we don't talk about it at all anymore. Now he's in seventh grade. And one of the ideas that I put forward on this show a while ago is that history works in public school in two ways. When we're little and we believe in Santas and tooth fairies and monsters, history is about this very rich, memorable fairy tale. Then when we get to middle school, where my nephew is, history just becomes about filling out worksheets and names, like you said, names and dates and boredom. And the takeaway from public school is you have all these fantastic stories like seared into your memory from those young days when you didn't know any better. And then you're left with this idea that it's just too boring from what you experienced in maybe 6th through 12th grade to ever want to look at it again. There's this switch when we're in elementary school. History is fun and magical, and it's an adventure, and there's heroes. And then when we have enough sense, I think, to reject some of those ideas, I'm certainly not suggesting that someone in elementary school is, you know, not capable of making sense of things. It's just, you know, it's an environment that's really more geared towards, like, you don't know what to do because you're a kid, and then there's these big adults who know stuff, and you kind of do what they say and think how they want. And I'm not saying that this is an intentional conspiracy. I'm just saying that it's very convenient that when we get to high school with all of these magical stories forever ingrained in our memory about the mythology of America, history switches to filling out worksheets and memorizing dates, Osborne. What else drives history?
Well, they talk a lot about conquering and warring and fighting and killing, right?
And presidents. It's always like around presidents too.
Presidents.
Like history is very much, I mean, I remember like my notes, some of my history notes from college are in that, and like the periods are like set up by presidential administrations.
Yeah, that's a good point. But I remember, so when I was in high school, I was on what was called Academic Bowl.
Ooh.
Where it was like a quiz show type thing where there were four people on the team and you'd compete against people from other schools and you had a little buzzer and you had to hit the buzzer and answer questions.
That's awesome.
And you could never like take materials with you, but you are always allowed to walk in with an empty notebook and a pen or a pencil.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing you do when you sit down at that table is you write down the name of every president in order and so that you can have that to look at. Because invariably, several of the questions during the match would involve presidents and knowing something about them.
Yeah. But the conquest is interesting because, yeah, I mean, most history is governments killing each other, right? And then the historians finding rationalizations for why that was necessary or why that was good. But there's some times where you just can't talk about conquest.
Right. Depending on who you are and which history you're reading, right?
Right. Sometimes you need to take what was a conquest and call it like a settlement or a discovery,
right?
So that's really what we're looking at here. And like I said, there's a bunch of missed opportunities. So if you don't know too much about this story, a lot of the deaths of Native Americans, because we always talk about people always want to ruin a Thanksgiving by saying the word genocide, the Thanksgiving dinner table, right? But a lot of this was more like an accidental biological warfare that led to the deaths of so many of these people. It's an interesting story that the first migration into the New World tens of thousands of years ago began, and they came from like through Russia, through the Bering Strait, where it's very, very cold. And they think that these cold temperatures actually like cleansed people of a lot of the diseases, because the pass through this area into this new world was multi-generational. They kind of went through this vacuum seal where they weren't bringing that bacteria with them. Here. The other thing too is that in this part of the world, to the best of knowledge of the best historians, there was no livestock here. So there were no cows, there were no horses, there were no goats, there were no pigs. Europeans brought all of that stuff with them when they came. In fact, the Aztecs were supposedly mesmerized when they saw Europeans or Spanish get off the boats on horses, and they said, yeah, these are the gods. Time to submit. But obviously, there's a lot of passing back and forth of disease between humans and livestock, especially in humans and animals generally when they were in closer quarters back in those days. So the Native Americans, first of all, I don't do the whole noble savage myth. They killed each other. They warred with each other. It wasn't like they were all peaceful and then the Europeans came slaughtered. I mean, there was conflict here before the Europeans came. Mm-hmm. But one thing that we know from Squanto, who became the most famous, you know, from all these natives in this pilgrim period, was that they did practice good hygiene. Mm. And the Europeans,
not so much,
were disgusting. They were filthy.
And they still are.
Yeah. Well, then, sorry, listeners in Europe, then they were especially filthy because they thought bathing was unhealthy, thought it was bad for you, even dangerous.
Now, I met people like that.
Really?
Right. Did you ever meet these like primal people who don't believe in soap?
What do they wash with?
Water.
Water would just make, have you ever like, have you ever found a hobo and just sprayed him with a hose and then smelled him afterwards?
No.
Oh, me neither. But imagine that situation, right?
Right, right.
When a stinky person, now I know this, right? Because I used to work in a residential school where a lot of kids didn't have good hygiene. They wouldn't want to shower. And for a lot of them, it was kind of a sad story. Like maybe bad things happened to them in the shower. And that was like a traumatic, like with the kids would sleep with jeans on, that kind of thing. So it was something that we tried to be very sensitive about. But they would go into the bathroom and just get in the shower to get wet.
Right.
Right, to get their hair wet.
Yes.
And so when they came out, they'd say, look, I took a shower.
Yeah, and they'd stink worse. It's like the water like exacerbates the smell.
Yeah, it would just make it worse.
Yeah, like a wet dog.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
So
anyway, I've known many people like this. It's not good.
So these wet pilgrims show up here. None of them have ever bathed. They're wearing the same clothes for a month. They wouldn't take off all their clothes at the same time because they thought, I read in a, what book was it? I think Lies My Teacher Told Me, they said it was immodest to get completely naked, stinky, dressed in dirty clothes, getting off a boat. They're kind of wet and they bring with them
disease.
All kinds of disease.
Wow.
Because the natives don't have the resistance to all these microbes that come from Europe. But this isn't the pilgrims that do this, right? Because when the pilgrims show up here in 1620, there's nobody. Now, remember, these are very superstitious people, right? They believe that God is guiding them, that they are righteous people. And they show up in Provincetown, Massachusetts, which is Provincetown, Massachusetts. Now, obviously, that had to be changed because that's like one of the gayest places on the East Coast today. You could see how conservatives wouldn't like that as the point of contact. But the Mayflower runs aground there, and then they send out scouting around the Massachusetts Bay to look for a place to settle. And what they find is that there's all this land that's already cleared. In some places, they found corn growing, but there was no people. So they thought this really kind of fed into their idea.
Like, oh yeah, God gave us this.
God gave us this.
Nice.
What had happened was for decades, this is another thing that's left out of the story too, the British had been trying to colonize mostly further south in Massachusetts, but they had failed again and again. But the British and the French had been fishing in that area for decades and interacting with the natives.
So,
go ahead.
Now, it's my impression that when these European settlers first came over here, like there weren't that many people on this continent. at that time, right? So how does disease spread so quickly?
It depends on when you're talking about, where you're talking about, who the settlers were, and this is something that's entirely, great point, Osborne, entirely omitted from the discussion that people have about this in public school. So therefore, it's like one out of six people that get some history in college. So almost nobody in this country knows anything about this.
Mm.
There is debate. Like in the book, it'll say something like a couple million people were here, right? Okay. In a textbook. Sometimes the estimates go as high as 14 million people in the New World at first contact with the Spanish.
Mm.
But what always happens, and you can see this again and again, no matter where you look, you see native populations, as soon as they have contact with Europeans, the native populations are reduced by sometimes basically between 90 and 100%. So just some examples of that. You talked about there also being like some kind of peace at first, right? And there are these stories that at first it was peaceful.
Yeah. So like I was reading Politically Incorrect Guide to American History by Thomas Woods. And he talked about how when the, you know, settlers came who weren't soldiers, that they were able to get along fairly well with native peoples and traded with each other and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean,
and it's when the government sent soldiers over to kill people that's when, you know, fighting and hostility broke out.
Well, you know how it works with any group. Like some people get along, some people don't. People mm-hmm. have a problem here that doesn't exist here. And as the British spread out, yeah, and they get involved in the fur trade, and there are some lucrative, mutually beneficial relationships, but there are also some land conflicts. And we're focusing in New England, right? Which is where the man wants us to look, right?
Okay.
Because there is stuff going on all down the East Coast. And in fact, there were areas of the East Coast settled long before Plymouth, Massachusetts, and these pilgrims. But that, we're going to get into that in a minute. It does not make for a very good, like, sort of founding and discovery, warm and fuzzy story of people seeking religious freedom, you know, as luck would have it, on the site of the world's freest country in the future. What a tale of destiny. But no, whenever they cross paths, the natives die. So in 1631, when they have their first conflict, there's some kind of conflict over land. And in the writing of the pilgrims, it says, "Thank God for sending smallpox."
That's kind of sick. That's like Chris Matthews stuff there.
A couple weeks ago, we played a clip of Chris Matthews from his election coverage saying he was glad the storm came because it helped Obama get reelected. Yeah, it's a similar kind of mysticism, but they thought if it happened, God wanted it. If God wanted it, it was good. It was our destiny.
Right.
You know, and we see that this is a belief that continued and allowed Europeans to move all the way to the West Coast, moving out whoever was in their way, right? It was these stories. This is the foundation that puts that mythology, that destructive mythology that led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of innocent people. This is the thinking. This is the fairy tale that got the ball rolling. So the reason why, back to the original story I was telling, that the pilgrims who are scouting the bay see all of this beautiful, lush farmland that is groomed and ready to plant, if it doesn't have stuff growing there already, is because all the people who had been maintaining it in years prior were dead. Because they had made contact, peaceful contact, maybe mutually beneficial trade-wise contact, with French and British fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
And then they died. So these plagues, I mean, this was really a plague that swept through all of these Native American communities in the Northeast. They couldn't even bury their dead. Like the pilgrims talk about these stories of finding like dead bodies. There's stories of the Spanish marching into some village maybe 100 years earlier, walking on top of bodies. It was that bad. Now, just to follow this into the future, what happens in 1849? Big event. So it's the gold rush, 1849. These people go to California to look for gold.
Gotcha.
20 years after that, 90% of the population, Native American population in California, is dead.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's nuts. So this is why Gene Roddenberry created the Prime Directive.
Now you're into some territory that I'm not familiar with.
Oh, you ever watched Star Trek?
Yeah.
Where they have this thing called the Prime Directive, meaning that when they travel to these other planets, they're not allowed to interact and interfere with the native populations.
Mm-hmm.
Probably for this very reason. So they don't give them all kinds of diseases and whatnot.
Interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You might have actually learned from history, as sci-fi often does. Mm-hmm. But at this point, we have an interesting question that's obviously explored in none of these books. because the impact of these disease, really this plague brought by Europe between 1492 that plays out like, gosh, you know, almost right into the 20th century. And we're talking about basically in 400 years, almost what is almost statistically on 100% population reduction of the people living here, mostly because of disease. Right. Wow. Now, it's hard to make antagonists out of the Europeans because are they dirty and stupid and mystical and, you know, superstitious? Sure. But they don't have the germ theory of disease.
Right.
Most of them. Now, there is the story of Amherst, General Jeffrey Amherst, who, under the guise of making peace with Native Americans, this is during the French and Indian War, 100 years later, when they know a little bit more, giving them like a trailer full of blankets.
Right.
That had been infected with smallpox.
Definitely heard that story.
To move them out of the way. Right. So that's the first example that I can think of intentional biological warfare. But the whole disease question is interesting because what does that mean and why is it omitted from the story? Like, oh, there was this terrible accident. You know, history talks about bad things that happen. Like, this was a bad accident because it takes away from the American exceptionalism of it, right? Because Europeans tried to go everywhere. They tried to go to India. They tried to go to the Middle East. They tried to go to Japan. They tried to go to China. And they couldn't, quote unquote, settle any of those places because they were already all filled with people.
Right.
So maybe they could use their military money.
So were they resistant to the diseases that were carried?
No, they were just there.
Oh, I
right?
see.
They might have had their own diseases, or they lived in close proximity, so it's safe to say that their tolerance to some of these microbes might have already been higher in China or Japan or the Middle East or India, which are all, at this time, equally filthy places, probably. But Europeans are able to settle the New World because it's empty. There's no one there because they're all dead from these earlier settlements. And maybe they could dominate those places later militarily. But the reason why, you know, the world isn't 100% British, and they used to say the sun never sets on the British Empire because of the colonies they had all over the places. But the French, the Spanish, the British could never settle those other places permanently, even though they might have tried in India, because they were already too populated because they didn't have this accidental biological warfare on their side. So it is by chance, these interactions with the Spanish and the French and the British prior to the pilgrims coming, that clears, you know, I hate to talk about this in such a cold way, but clears out all this land and leaves just skeletons. And we have this story of this character, Squanto, who is like the willing volunteer to help the pilgrims learn how to farm, who's just kind of standing on the shore waiting for them to arrive and help them out, right? But there's more to that as well. If you're just joining us, what we've covered so far tonight is, for some reason, I wanted to do a show about the appeal to tradition. But then, for some reason, I just went off on this tangent about the true history, or a truer history. Obviously, there's a lot of gray areas in this story. And there is a lot of debate about what actually happened, when the pilgrims came, why they came, where they were trying to go, which we're going to talk about in a minute.
It was a long time ago, and we weren't there.
Yeah, and at the very least, it's an investigation that would be stimulating for young people to have, but they do not have it because they're given this prepackaged, recycled, generation after generation fairy tale that has, you know, no moral dimension, no opportunity for inquiry, and virtually no existence of conflict. Right?
I got to tell you, my daughter is obsessed with pilgrims. She wants to know everything there is about pilgrims. We take her down to Massachusetts, to, you know, Plymouth and all these places to see museums of pilgrims and whatnot. Maybe I'll have to get some resources from you to help her know the truth.
The pre-learning that she'll have to do is she'll need to know what cannibalism is. And
well, we work on that at home.
So go over some vocabulary with her. Cannibalism and grave robbing.
She's also obsessed with cemeteries, so
that's nice.
It'll work out.
So we were talking about, before we took our break at the top of the hour, we were talking about this gentleman named Squanto, right? Who is this willing volunteer Native American who seems to be standing on the shores of Massachusetts waiting for the pilgrims to arrive. Right? And he teaches them to farm, and it's a story of cooperation that leads to the first Thanksgiving. But this story, with all its drama, it's like asking us to look away from something else. Mm. And during the break, I asked the people in the chat to participate in a trivia question. Most people in the chat got this right. I said, what was the first British settlement in the New World? And it was actually, the real answer is actually Roanoke, Virginia.
Mm.
But the permanent settlement, the first permanent settlement, and this is something that a lot of people know, was Jamestown. What became named Jamestown, Virginia. Mm. Virginia named after the Virgin Queen.
Oh, name. I didn't know that.
But why not Virginia? Such an exciting story, too. And really a story that's kind of intriguing. You've all heard of Sir Walter Raleigh, right? He's got a kind of cigarettes named after him.
Right.
Raleigh,
North Carolina?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, Raleigh is just a sea captain, and he is interested in, as early as the 1580s, doing some exploring over here and establishing a permanent settlement entirely for, you know, money-making purposes, which is why a lot of colonies are set up. There was royal colonies that were set up by the crown. There was proprietary colonies like Pennsylvania set up by William Penn, you know, like where a person starts a colony. And then, of course, there were these corporate colonies that were, you know, chartered. So Virginia is where the British start, right? Because they have to start at a point far enough north where they're not going to be bothered by the Spanish, who pretty much have total control of Florida in the 1580s. There's a conflict brewing, too, because these are the two powers in the world at that time. The Spanish with their armada, which is world famous, and the British.
And their Inquisition.
Which is also a few decades later. Oh. The Inquisition was a few decades before this period we're talking about. So the Spanish decide that they are, for once and for all, going to take care of the British. Here's another one of these hand of God type events. In 1588, they send the Armada to sail up the, is it the Thames River? Is that how you pronounce that? Thames?
That's how I've heard it pronounced.
Okay. And they are going to invade London. Wipe the British out, destroy their fleet, and colonize all of the New World for themselves. That's the plan. Hand of God. A storm comes, blows the armada, scatters the armada out of formation, and these small British clipper ships can go out into the channel and pick them off. And that's the end. And after that, the New World belonged to the French and the British until the 7 Years' War, which in our history is called the French and Indian War because those were the opponents. And then it becomes just the British. But the Spanish are out of the picture by the time in the early 1600s that they start to colonize in the central, you know, East Coast, Virginia. So Raleigh goes with a boat full of people and drops them off. And he's like, all right, start a colony. I'll be back. So he comes back with another boatload of people years later.
Mm-hmm.
Like the first drop off is, I think, like 1585. So then that whole 1588 thing happens where the British are able to establish what will eventually become preeminence, but get the Spanish out of the way. So he comes back with more people. Surprise, everyone he dropped off before, dead.
Are they dead or are they just disappeared?
Or gone. They're gone. Raleigh looks around, sees that there's no one there. He's got 100 people on a boat with him. He's like, all right, I'll be back. See ya. Start a colony. And he comes back, I think, in the early 1590s. Holy crap, everyone's gone.
Wow.
And carved into one of the trees as a word, I think it's Croatan, I think is what they, for all we know, they think that's a place. They go to the place they think it is. No one's there.
Hmm.
So this was the first colonial attempt over a couple decades by the British in the New World. We've got this story where these people disappear.
Right.
But you never hear about this story in high school history. And like that was a theory that the people were like taken by something supernatural. And you said, kids.
Yeah, they eat that stuff up.
They
man.
Would love a story like that.
Yeah.
I remember.
I mean, I read about it when I was a kid in my history books, but I mean, I was a homeschool kid.
I thought that would be such a good hook, you know, like it isn't just this boring crap that like your science book seems to be or your math book seems to be or whatever you're reading in English class. Ethan Frome or the Scarlet Letter or, you know, even things that could be fun if you chose them yourself and explored them yourself. There's a lot of opportunity for in this exploration of history, which I've said so many times, history is conspiracy. A lot of times what history is when people find out about a conspiracy that's already in progress. So there's this whole Croatan story is completely omitted from the big picture because there's a connection to Jamestown that just can't happen because it doesn't fit the myth, the Jamestown story. So it is assumed, I know we jumped away from Squanto and this wonderful story about the Mass Bay colony and the pilgrims and the seeking of religious freedom and the friendship they formed with Squanto, but this is what we're supposed to look away from. The Jamestown story must be omitted, right? And we have to focus on this other. And the connection between the two places is that a lot of people who are on the Mayflower, which is like 100 and some odd people, only about a third of them are pilgrims, think they're going to Virginia.
Right.
So all of the people who are on the Mayflower, or two-thirds of the people, are expecting to go to Virginia because they want to start getting in on this whole tobacco farming thing. And this is a whole other tale. We talked about farming a little bit in the pre-show. If you didn't hear this, tobacco was obviously Virginia's main cash crop and probably the surrounding states as well once they established permanent settlements and started farming there. But farms can't use all their land at the same time, Osborne. Not a farmer, right? Neither okay. am I. But
no, but I used to live in the middle of farms.
But you would see that there would be a lot of, in the vast expanse of a farm, there would be empty land.
You said this, and I don't remember ever seeing this. What I would see is they would have different crops there each year in the same spots.
My understanding of it is that when you use the land over and over again for, yield after yield of crops, the soil becomes less nutrient rich and just gets like dry and sandy and stuff won't grow there.
Mm.
Because, all of that volume of crops sucks the nutrients and, the fertility out of that soil.
Sure.
So tobacco is a particularly caustic crop that drains the soil of its nutrients even faster and turns farmland into desert wasteland. The people in Virginia, they plant it everywhere. They ruin the farmland. They don't even plant food. The colonial governor of Virginia at one point has to pass a law mandating that people grow food because they're filling up all the land with tobacco and you're selling it while they starve. So, and of course, there could have been trade arrangements worked out and it might have been a different story in a different place. But Virginia is like just not a good story, right? It's so much better to, we've got Squanto, the willing helper. The Virginia situation would not have provided us with such warm and fuzzy feelings. At about the same time that the pilgrims are showing up, the British were taking natives prisoners in Virginia and forcing them to teach them how to farm.
Hmm.
At one point, just a couple years after that, maybe 10 years after the pilgrim has arrived.
Now, was there not farming that occurred in Europe?
Most people were not farmers. And think about it. England has no, why is this so valuable to the British especially? Because England has been populated, like densely populated for over 1,000 years at this point. They build ships. There's no trees. They farm the crap out of whatever good farmland they had. So Britain's colonialization of, if you look at their ambitions, the rest of the entire world has to do with what all colonialization has to do with, raw materials. Mm. They need to go other places to get this stuff. Now, obviously, they have some farms there, but it seemed like most people just didn't know what to do. They had no clue. And obviously, if they're taking native prisoners and making them teach them how to farm, a few years later, some British military offers a friendship toast to like the tribal elders of one of the tribes in the area for eternal friendship.
Yeah.
It's poison. They die.
So, oh, man.
This is long before, over 120, 130 years before Geoffrey Amherst and his smallpox blankets.
Hmm.
So people know about Jamestown. And in some places, it's just absolutely unavoidable. Like, it gets so bad in Virginia in the early going that they're cannibals.
Wow.
Right? They're digging up bodies of Native Americans and eating them.
Out of the ground?
Out of the ground.
After they died of disease?
Well, this is kind of the other thing, too, right? Remember all these gold myths that the Spanish forwarded about El Dorado and rivers of gold and cities of gold?
Fountain of youth.
So a lot of the people come to Virginia on these, like, get-rich-quick missions.
Nice.
And before they figure out that, like, the only way they can do it is by farming and trading, they show up and they're like, let's dig for gold, So they just start digging everywhere for gold. Maybe they come across a body. They say, oh, wow, I'm hungry. Whatever the story is. But, it's desperate times for them. And it's easy for us to look back, completely detached from this. And obviously, there's no defending this. And I'm not into judging people in the context of their times. Like, I remember, talking to my kids in school about Columbus, the school that was run by these real conservative, the administrators at the school were real conservative. And they heard me talking about Columbus.
And they said, well, you know, they didn't know any better then. Well, all these people were Christians, right? Mm. So Christianity was never called Genghis Khananity. Right? It was always about the worship of Jesus with the golden rule and do unto others. And it's never okay to dig up dead bodies and eat them. It was never okay for the Spanish to hack people's hands off who couldn't find enough gold for them in one day.
Mm.
Right? So they knew better. They knew better. If they were Christians and they believed in that and they weren't just using Christianity, as it so often is, and other religions as well, as an excuse to rape and pillage and kill people who are not Christians. So there's a lot of very interesting stories going on in Virginia, right? Lateral, completely same time as the Pilgrim story is unfolding in the North. What makes Plymouth so memorable?
Thanksgiving.
Turkey. A little story, about a turkey. So, like we were saying earlier, the Mayflower runs aground on a sandbar in what would later become Provincetown, Massachusetts. They start scouting. They find these fields, and there's no rock. That's a myth.
It was. And I still want to hear about the Squanto.
Yeah, so we had talked about the importance of the Pilgrim story as the diversion from the disaster F-fest that's going on
in Virginia.
So we have Squanto, the willing helper who appears to be waiting for the Pilgrims. Now, why is he there waiting? Why is he willing to help them? Well, all his people were dead, right? They had all died from these diseases.
Why didn't he die?
That's an interesting question. Do you want to know why?
Yes.
Because when this wave of disease, this plague, as some have called it, swept through what became New England, Squanto was in Europe.
How did he get there?
This is the story. Now, there are different levels of intrigue in this story. But supposedly, the British fishermen had been coming here since the 1580s, right? So the idea that, you know, Plymouth was the first British exploration, the bravery, all that crap that goes with it. Same thing with the Columbus story. What was that, 130 years earlier? The British had been in this area for some time. And when Squanto was like five, it's difficult to determine his age when the Pilgrims show up. But when he was a little boy, he was basically stolen from his people by British fishermen and brought back to the UK, right? And well, I mean, these you know, and he shows
for why.
Him, oh, look what I found over there. Look at this. Look at this one. He's
like a,
weird.
Like a circus act.
Yeah, you know, that kind of a thing to exhibit, right? And Columbus did this too. Columbus had done this too. He had brought the natives, the Arawaks that he found in the Caribbean, back to show the king and the queen. So kidnapping natives and bringing them back and saying, look at this little weird guy that I found over there. You know, maybe with some gold also helps. You know, people are funding these expeditions. But Squanto spends maybe as much as a decade in England. And then the story is that he winds up in Spain and eventually, through which must have just been an amazing journey to be pulled away from your home as a boy and taken to basically what was like another planet, it must have seemed, Great Britain at that time. And then to industriously work your way back to your own people to find them. I think he got back there like right before, a year before the Pilgrims showed up, and they're all gone. They're all dead. It's an amazing story, entirely omitted.
So he just hung out with his bad self for a year?
It's hard to say what he did, but obviously now you can see why when humans show up, who are not just a pile of bones lying by the side of what used to be their home, he's excited, right? It's great to see people who aren't bones.
I can imagine.
Yeah, if all you see is bones. So he embraces them. Now there's other stories too that there was a financial incentive that Squanto had been sent there. I don't know too much about that story, but just to be fair, there are multiple interpretations. I will check the chat during the break to see if anyone can add any insights into this. But he's there. He speaks English. He's got skills, right, when it comes to farming and all that. He was absent for this wave of disease that killed all his people, and he's happy to see people show up. So he taught them everything. Pretty much. And there was other, he acted as an interpreter, which helped them set up the fur trade. He showed them how to farm. And this all leads to this great story of this great harvest and feast that became over 100 years later Thanksgiving. Because it wasn't even something that was officially celebrated till Abraham Lincoln. And we're speculating. We try to never get into one of these speculations on the show. But Osborne and I were talking about this before, and it was Lincoln who did it, right? So maybe this was like at a time of great conflict and division in the country.
Right.
Let's all remember our common roots kind of thing. Like you were saying about Obama.
Right. I was listening. He was talking on the way over here to us that this is the day that we remember that despite our differences, we are all foremost Americans.
And I said, that's the theme of every Obama speech since for the last 4 years.
Right.
Let's put our differences aside, please. You're killing me with our differences here. So that's a theory about why Lincoln made Thanksgiving a holiday. But when we look at these pilgrims and we look at their superstition and their complete ineptitude when it even came to their own survival, how they hastily came over here. And obviously they were fleeing a bad situation. That much is true. It is does require a tremendous amount of courage to cross an ocean in a little boat, not knowing where you're going, not knowing what's going to be there for you, leaving people that you care about behind. Mm-hmm. But they bring with them this attitude of we're God's chosen people, right? So we come, and this myth obviously is exaggerated and magnified by the fact that when they finally, you know, make landfall and scout around a little bit and find all this cleared land, these nice fields, corn growing, food ready, we are clearly God's chosen people. Remember, yeah, they were Puritans.
Right.
This is where we wrap up our regular show for the night. Can you believe it? It seems like we started like half hour ago.
I can't believe it at all. I could listen to this for hours.
What, my stories?
Yeah, I love stories.
Well, all of these circumstances that we pretty much spent the whole show talking about, all of these happenings, all of these events that lead up to the first Thanksgiving, just about everything that's important, everything that really influences it is omitted from the story, right? The disease aspect, which is the only reason that Europeans were probably able to permanently settle this land. Mm. And all this does is Thanksgiving memorializes the superstitions, the Eurocentrism, right? The God is on our side attitude forever. Making it a tradition. Like I said, we were going to talk about the appeal to tradition. I guess we kind of did because, you know, tradition, the appeal to tradition as well, it's always been that way.
Mm.
Certainly not something that Thanksgiving isn't questioned by most people, right? But think about what Thanksgiving means and what it memorializes. We are God's chosen people. Where does this go in the United States? I mean, if we play it way into the future, manifest destiny, right? Basically using the same strategy, an even more violent and aggressive Indian removal, as it's called by the friggin' government strategy, to bring this thing all the way to California.
Hmm.
Right? But this is the template. This is tradition. This story is mostly false. Did they have a harvest? Sure. That's what you have at the end of October. Beast might follow that. The Indians had probably done this for generations.
Mm-hmm.
You ever remember Thanksgiving as an anagram? That every letter in Thanksgiving means a thing, and kids used to recite this in school, right? I is for Indians,
uh-huh,
who we invited to share our food. Right?
Well, that was nice of us.
So this is where the myth reaches the level of truly horrifying. Now, that's just a sort of anecdotal example. And I went through, I was at my brother's house and I was looking through the kids' work to see like there was a turkey made out of a paper bag, but that was all I saw, right? I was looking for these kind of handouts. And my brother said to me, yeah, Brett, it's the same crap that we were taught. You know, I was in first grade 29 years ago. He says, nothing has changed.
So is V for Virginia where we ate dead people?
Probably not.
No.
If you look at what I was, this thing is pretty far from the truth. But it was the opposite of the truth, that the Europeans, these filthy, superstitious, grave-digging maniacs who stink, came here and civilized a group of savages. And Thanksgiving commemorates that. That's the story. Wow. Like, the Indians were lucky to participate. When you like let a generation or two go by with that kind of attitude, you know, God is on our side attitude, what does that mean for the people of Massachusetts? Where do they go? To a good place? No. Is a rhetorical question. No, it's obviously a bad place, right? Right. 20 years later, the Mass Bay Colony is a total theocracy, mm-hmm. right? First, sin becomes crime. And eventually, this is the same place, maybe a generation or two later, where sin becomes witchcraft.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Can we have an episode where we talk about witches?
But that is a more accurate story of the first Thanksgiving and the ideological tradition of America that this myth establishes. It's not about genocide. The pilgrims are such a small part of that. When you look at all the people who died violently, you know, being on the wrong side of swords or guns or, you know, knives of Europeans, the pilgrims were relatively peaceful. You know, they did do a little grave digging. But when you show up here and you're like, wow, look at these fields. Mm. You know, look at how beautiful everything is. Look at how we found this religious freedom. Mm. With God already smiling down on us. And, you know, why not do a little grave digging?
Now, my understanding of when you disturb Indian burial grounds is that you become haunted by poltergeists.
Yeah, it gets to be real poltergeisty. You know?
Did that happen too?
Fortunately, no, because they didn't have any TVs. Oh. And remember the TV? Was that Drew Barrymore? No.
No.
I don't think so.
No.
TV was a big part of that movie. We're talking about a horror movie from the early 80s called Poltergeist. Wasn't there another one? Stephen King? The Pet Cemetery.
Oh, quite
right. Yeah, that was an Indian burial ground. Whoa. What other movie has a building that's very spooky built on top of an Indian burial ground? I'll tell you the name of the place. You tell me the movie. The Overlook Hotel.
Oh, I don't know this one.
Shine.
Oh, quite right.
Remember from last
now
week.
We come full circle.
Ah, yes. Neat. Neat. So, yeah, this was a story that ignited my interest. Like I said at the very beginning of the show today, I wanted to devote some time to this tonight because you told the same story, Osborne. This was something that got me very interested in history. And it also should make us reflect, make us understand all of the missed opportunities. Like this is a concrete example of just one of the many missed opportunities to do the same thing for young people when they're in all those years of government school. And it just never happens. I mean, look at we told some pretty interesting stories tonight, right?
Mm-hmm.
None of them are told in school.
No, none.
If they were told in school, I wouldn't tell them on the show. Yeah, you know, thanks to everyone in the chat. This was great. Maybe we could look at a couple comments before we leave.
Yeah, thankful for that.
Reminds me of the scene from the Addams Family movie where Wednesday is in a Thanksgiving play.
Oh, yeah, and she gets all morose and morbid with it, as is her way.
Ah, yes, but then she turned into Christina Ricci, who was beautiful. You have been listening to School Sucks Live with me tonight, Osborne. Thanks for doing it.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me, sir.
And I'm Brett. I'm the host of School Sucks Podcast. You can check out my podcast at schoolsucks.podomatic.com. Subscribe on iTunes. Subscribe on YouTube. Follow us on Twitter, School Sucks Show. Like us on Facebook. Put in School Sucks Podcast. You'll find us. Thank you so much again, everybody, for listening, for your participation. We will be back on schoolsucksproject.com/live in less than 5 minutes.
Bye, Johnny. Don't you slip up or play the fool.
New subscriber, geography, trivia. You just say a person's name and then tell a fact about where they live.
Okay, first of all, I just want to say thank you to Darius and Janaea for their one-time donations. Always appreciated. And also a listener named Manuel, who I didn't get any address information from, and I tried to email and ask him, you know, send me your address, Manuel, so I can tell you something interesting about the place you live. But I didn't hear back, but I did still want to say thank you. So let's start today with Joel,
who is from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Now, in keeping with the theme of today's show, did you know that Santa Fe, New Mexico is the second oldest town in the United States? The Spanish founded Santa Fe in 1607. That's 13 years before our pilgrim friends in Plymouth. What's the oldest? Well, now you know, and you already did know, Jamestown, Virginia. Next, we have Kent, who is in Indianapolis. Here's another one related to kind of what we were talking about on the show. Did you know that almost nobody spoke English in Indianapolis until the late 1700s? The story is, like, that was all French territory for more than 100 years. It wasn't until the British won the Seven Years' War and the Treaty of Paris was signed, the French surrendered, and the area became English-speaking. How about that? Next, we have Terry, who is in San Rafael, California. This is the George Lucas capital of the world. I'm surprised I didn't know this. He set up there in 1970 to film the movie THX-1138, and that's where Lucasfilm was based until the mid-20-aughts. Actually, one of George Lucas's other good movies, American Graffiti, was filmed in downtown San Rafael. And Industrial Light and Magic was also based in San Rafael, founded in 1975. The Clone Wars was on TV the other day. Damn, that movie sucks. And finally, today we have Keegan, who is in the Phoenix, Arizona area. And if I just want to share this with you. Keegan sent me an email a couple weeks ago, and I'm not going to read it because I didn't get his permission to actually read it. But the gist of it was he saw that I was looking for subscribers, but mentioned that he kind of missed the old style of School Sucks podcast before we did these live shows. And the live shows certainly have, in addition to all of the technical challenges, content challenges, because we're on the fly. Sometimes I overlook things that really should be inserted, and I try to record non-live segments before or after the show to cover some of that stuff. But yes, I certainly have received a few of these emails. I wanted to share my response to that email. I often feel the same way, and I'm trying to balance between the old show style and the live show. The live show was supposed to be supplemental to what I was already doing, but it has been so time-consuming that it seems to have completely replaced the old format. I wanted the live show for YouTube content and for a new challenge, but I completely understand what you are saying. I have actually received a lot of comments on the live show, and most of them have been positive. My goal is one live show and one old format show each week and one original video per month. But I am really a one-man operation. I am trying to manage my time better so I can be more productive. The subscription content has a few unreleased podcasts, but it's mostly after shows, which are even less focused than the live shows. Anything that I deem to be really essential content goes into the regular feed. Thanks for the input, and I assure you that I am trying to push everything in the right direction. And he wrote a response saying, I guess you need these resources so you can build the show that you really want, or at least continue evolving and improving. And then he subscribed. So thank you very much, Keegan. I really appreciate that email as well, because he said, if you did this, I would feel better about making a contribution every month. So if you're in the same position, if there's something that you're waiting for, let me know, because the next show, per Keegan's request, will not be live, and it should be out within a day or so. Oh, and Phoenix, by the way, and I guess Arizona generally, if you're from the eastern part of the United States, you might be surprised to learn this. Speed limit there on interstates is 75 miles an hour. Out here everywhere, it is 65. I've never been on a road. Like, I've been places in those airplanes out west, but I have never driven on a road where the speed limit was 75 miles an hour in my life. Neat. But I'll tell you what, I've driven plenty here on the East Coast, especially in Massachusetts on the interstates, and cops, even though the speed limit is 65, cops like 75. You know, I've driven by plenty of cops on I-95, I-93, and they give you kind of like a quick nod, like you're bold, but not careless. And then in Massachusetts, they pull me over anyway and search my car for fireworks.
New subscriber, geography, trivia. You just say a person's name and they tell a fact about where they live.
So what do you got? You want to get into that article?
Sure. Like way earlier in the night, we were talking about going to college and having your mind open to like all kinds of different new possibilities of what you haven't been learning your entire life.
Sure.
So my one professor I had in school who was like that for me, his name was Richard Ebeling. And our listeners may know of him. He's a very well-respected man in the area of history of economic thought.
Mm-hmm.
He was the president of Foundation for Economic Education for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Or not a long time, but a few years anyway. He's the one who's well-known for going over to Russia with his wife and uncovering the lost papers of Ludwig von Mises and smuggling them out. And that was kind of a big deal.
Wow. Back
in the day. Anyway, but his class was the first one I had on the first day of school, 8 o'clock in the morning, and like completely blew my mind right out of the gate. I don't even remember what he talked about that day. Mm-hmm. But I do remember in particular when it came around to Thanksgiving time, he had an interesting take on the Thanksgiving story. And I believe he published an article here that I've got pulled up back in 2009. So it was quite a few years after I met the fellow, but he's also he started the Future of Freedom Foundation with Bumper Hornberger back in the day as well.
Bumper?
Yes, Jeffrey Hornberger as his.
Is this Jacob Hornberger's dad?
Yeah, Jacob Hornberger. That's who I'm thinking.
Bumper? You call him Bumper?
That's what everybody calls him.
Why?
I don't know. This is a nickname.
I want that to be my nickname.
Yeah.
Bumper Yellowfinger.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So anyway, he's got this article here about Thanksgiving, and I'll read it. It's called The True Meaning of Thanksgiving, The Birth of Private Enterprise in America by Richard M. Ebeling. This time of the year, whether in good economic times or bad, is when Americans gather with their families and friends and enjoy a Thanksgiving meal together. It marks a remembrance of those early pilgrim fathers who crossed the uncharted ocean from Europe to make a new start in Plymouth, Massachusetts. What is less appreciated is that Thanksgiving is also a celebration of the birth of free enterprise in America. The English Puritans who left Great Britain and sailed across the Atlantic on the Mayflower in 1620 were not only escaping from religious persecution in their homeland, they also wanted to turn their back on what they viewed as the materialistic and greedy corruption of the old world. In the new world, they wanted to erect a new Jerusalem that would not only be religiously devout, but be built on a new foundation of communal sharing and social altruism. Their goal was the communism of Plato's Republic, in which all would work and share in common, knowing neither private property nor self-interested acquisitiveness. What resulted is recorded in the diary of Governor William Bradford, the head of the colony. The colonists collectively cleared and worked the land, and they brought forth neither the bountiful harvest they hoped for, nor did it create a spirit of shared and cheerful brotherhood. The less industrious members of the colony came late to work in the fields, and were slow and easy in their labors. Knowing that they and their families were to receive an equal share of whatever the group produced, they saw little reason to work more diligently in their efforts. The harder working among the colonists became resentful that their efforts would be redistributed to the more malingering members of the colony. Soon they too were coming late to work and were less energetic in the fields. As Governor Bradford explained in his Old English, though with the spelling modernized, "For the young men that were able and fit for labor and service did repine that they should spend their time and strength to work for other men's wives and children without recompense. The strong or men of parts had no division of food, clothes, etc., than that he was weak and not able to do a quarter the others could. This was thought injustice. The aged and graver men to be ranked and equalized in labor and food, clothes, etc., with the meaner and younger sort, thought it some indignant and disrespect unto them. And for men's wives to be commended to do service for other men, as dressing their meat, washing their clothes, etc., they deemed it a kind of slavery. Neither could husbands brook it." Because of the disincentives and resentments that spread among the population, crops were sparse, and the rationed equal shares from the collective harvest were not enough to ward off starvation and death. 2 years of communism in practice had left alive only a fraction of the original number of the Plymouth colonists. Realizing that another season like those that had just passed would mean the extinction of the entire community, the elders of the colony decided to try something radically different: the introduction of private property rights and the right of the individual families to keep the fruits of their own labor. As Governor Bradford put it, "And so assign to every family a parcel of land according to the proportion of their number for that end. This had a good, very good success, for it made all hands very industrious, so as much more corn was planted than otherwise would have been by any means the governor or any other could use, and saved him a great deal of trouble, and grave far better content. The women now went willingly into the field and took their little ones with them to set corn, which before would allege weakness and inability, and whom to have compelled would have been thought great tyranny and oppression. The Plymouth colony experienced a great bounty of food. Private ownership meant that there was now a close link between work and reward. Industry became the order of the day as the men and women in each family went to the fields on their separate private farms. When the harvest time came, not only did many families produce enough for their own needs, but they had surpluses that they could freely exchange with their neighbors for mutual benefit and improvement." In Governor Bradford's words, "By the time harvest has come, and instead of famine, now God gave them plenty, and the face of things was changed to the rejoicing of the hearts of many, for which they blessed God, and the effect of their planting was well seen, for all had, one way or another, pretty well to bring the year about, and some of the abler sort and more industrious had to spare and sell to others, so as any general want or famine hath not been amongst them since to this day." Hard experience had taught the Plymouth colonists the fallacy and error in the ideas that since the time of the ancient Greeks had promised paradise through collectivism rather than individualism. As Governor Bradford expressed it, "The experience that was had in this common course and condition, tried sundry years, and that amongst the godly and sober men may well convince of the vanity and conceit of Plato's and other ancients, that the taking away of property and bringing into a commonwealth would make them happy and flourishing, as if they were wiser than God. For this community, so far as it was found to breed confusion and discontent, and retard much employment that would have been to their benefit and comfort." Was this realization that communism was incompatible with human nature and the prosperity of humanity to be despaired or be a cause for guilt? Not in Governor Bradford's eyes. It was simply a matter of accepting that altruism and collectivism were inconsistent with the nature of man, and that human institutions should reflect the reality of man's nature if he is to prosper. Said Governor Bradford, "Let none object. This is man's corruption, and nothing to the curse itself. I answer, seeing all men have this corruption in them, God in his wisdom saw another course fitter for them." The desire to spread the wealth and for government to plan and regulate people's lives is as old as the utopian fantasy in Plato's Republic. The Pilgrim Fathers tried and soon realized its bankruptcy and failure as a way for men to live together in society. They instead accepted man as he is, hardworking, productive, and innovative when allowed the liberty to follow his own interests in improving his own circumstances and that of his family. And even more, out of his industry result the quantities of useful goods that enable men to trade to their mutual benefit. In the wilderness of the New World, the Plymouth Pilgrims had progressed from the false dream of communism to the sound realism of capitalism. At a time of economic uncertainty, it is worthwhile recalling this beginning of the American experiment and experience with freedom. This is the lesson of the first Thanksgiving. This year, when we Americans sit around our dinner table with family and friends, we should also remember that we are really celebrating the birth of free men and free enterprise in the new world of America. The true meaning of Thanksgiving, in other words, is the triumph of capitalism over the failure of collectivism in all its forms. So this story, Brett, is kind of a departure from what we were talking about before. So I'm wondering, is this something of a mythology as well that people of our persuasion might be pulling out of their asshole?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it is. And I think the giveaway is at the end. I think the giveaway is in the conclusion. The true meaning of Thanksgiving, in other words, is the triumph of capitalism over the failure of collectivism in all its forms. These people were fucking Puritans. They were as collectivist as they came. It was all about... So he finds a way for commerce to work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it was self-sacrifice in every other respect, which is completely omitted from this. Religion isn't mentioned once in this. No, this is confirmation bias, right? He's setting out to find the story in this that he wants to, and that means having to circumnavigate certain aspects of the story that I think are important and that paint these people in a different light, right?
Mm-hmm.
And somebody could just as easily say, well, this was only made possible because they pillaged and stole before that. So You can't say that this is capitalism in its truest form because they didn't even homestead the land. Now, okay, here's an interesting question. If the people who had been the first users of that land, the first to mix their labor with natural resources, were dead, what does that mean? Because they come to this land, right? It's already cut. It's already groomed for farming.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just kind of take it. They're also digging graves, too, which is kind of, sure. You know, grave digging is not very free market. But he's choosing something that he wants to focus on, right?
Sure. So, I mean, it's one element of a bigger picture.
Yeah, and there's a lot of there's a lot of different angles, I think, that you can examine this story from. So it's an interesting addition.
So there's a select group of people who've figured out a way to be more productive in their own community.
Mm-hmm.
I guess.
I wonder what percent of the population is covered in this tale.
It sounded just like the one settlement with William Bradford.
Okay. Right? So he's also doing Bill Maher's favorite trick, which is the fallacy of composition, right? Mm. He's creating this settlement, this American colonies, pilgrims myth out of one isolated example. So it's also kind of a hasty generalization that these people, this is why this is such an important story about the foundation of America, you know?
Well, this is the same group of people that is focused on with the more traditional Thanksgiving story too, right?
Well, what did this guy teach when you had him as a economics?
Economics, yeah.
Okay, so you probably didn't get into it. He didn't have to offer.
No, this wasn't history. The history classes I had in college were all taught by the right-wing wingnut who Manifest Destiny made him, have to change his shorts.
Change your shorts in a good way or change your shorts in a bad way?
In a happy way.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, then I think that fits, that we're definitely looking at a myth here, right? Mm-hmm. Where if the entire push of all the material is from a very, like, American exceptionalist conservative standpoint, yeah, this story fits that. It's like, oh, you know, freedom, exploration, capitalism, like, that all fits into that right-wing thing. So I think that maybe this story is true, but as an isolated example, it's a composition fallacy. It's the fallacy of omission in a very important way. Now, obviously, he didn't have the responsibility to give you a complete history if he was an economics teacher. But how do we know in the village next door there isn't some guy who never produced anything for himself licking some poor Indian's femur bone that he dug up? Fucking filthy scumbag piece of shit.
I'm going to start calling you Mel Gibson.
But yeah, I mean, these are people, like, people fled. This was the colony that people fled because of its religious tyranny. Mm. Ironic, they came from Britain for religious freedom. But the reason why most of the Northeast was colonized was people running away from these guys, you know, as the rest of the 17th century played out. Who's the Rhode Island guy? Roger Williams.
There you go.
Right? So Providence. He runs off into the woods, basically, and comes to this place, Providence, intervention from God, Provincetown, same thing. So these people had God on their side, you know, that sort of story seems to fit in that, oh, shit, while they're there, you know, getting religious freedom and setting up a free country, laying the groundwork for a free country, they also discover capitalism. I like it, but I put a couple quotes into the chat. No one responded to them. Did you see them? Couple of quotes from the article.
Oh, no.
First one was men of parts. And the second one was dressing their meat.
I dressed my meat today.
What does that mean?
Put some gravy on it.
Oh, actually meat. Yeah, actually, like, in the real sense of dressing your meat.
So anyway, it's probably useful to address this particular libertarian myth of Bradford colony. I've noticed especially over the past 5 years, there's been a really pervasive meme among our people to talk about this at Thanksgiving.
You're kidding me. Like, where are you running into this?
Several places. I showed you that there's a HuffPo piece by Ben Powell today, basically reiterating that, which was a recycling of basically the same article he published a few years back.
Yeah, Benjamin Powell, Thanksgiving and the Pilgrim's Real Lesson. Okay, well, if he's...
It's the same thing we just read. I think even last year I read an article that someone published that was kind of a debunking of this story.
Well, if this, even if this story is true, you don't get to say Thanksgiving and the Pilgrims' real lesson, right? Because the Pilgrims is a catch-all term for everybody who existed in colonial America at that period, right? It was 35 people on that boat that came here, right? So think about how hyper-focused this story has to be to ignore everything else that's going on around it. 35 people on a boat out of 100 were the actual Pilgrims, and they weren't called that until almost the end of the 1800s.
Now, did those other people, did they hang out with them or did they go somewhere else?
I think they stayed. I think they had to. And that was the other great myth of the Mayflower Compact. But the idea with the Mayflower Compact was like it was a voluntary democratic government that they set up. The first example of the setting up of a voluntary participatory democratic government.
And it wasn't?
It was I think it was an attempt to settle the initial tensions of like, this is not Virginia, you fucks.
So, the Pilgrims weren't getting along with the other folk?
It's possible. I actually don't know that much about that, but there was tension from the beginning. And I think it had to do with the fact that, we don't know really what happened because we don't know if the boat was really supposed to go to Virginia or if they mutinied. Like if they hijacked it and took it somewhere else purposely, because everyone in Virginia was Anglican and that's what they were trying to escape. They were just there to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So why would the Pilgrims want to get on a boat that's going to go to a place that's just like mini England culturally? Mm-hmm. The story that goes into most of the mainstream textbooks is that a storm blew them off course, which helps with the whole divine hand kind of part of it. So we've done a lot of show tonight. How do you feel?
Yeah, we have.
Anything else, any other issues that anybody in the chat is interested in? Was Brett a history teacher, James asks. Yes, I was. Why are you asking that? Because it's like Brett seems like a history teacher, but I don't know anything about his bio. Or is your tone when you ask that, was Brett a history teacher?
Like, God, this is boring. This is like my history class.
Or he doesn't know what he's talking about. Which way? Explain yourself. James 6:30. Then someone says, hold on the chat. He laughs out loud. Did you really, James? Did you really laugh out loud? No, you know a lot about history. That's all. Thanks. Bump, he says. That's when you want something to go okay. to
fist,
the top.
Fist bump?
No, a bump. Oh, maybe that's what he means. Like bump, you know, like pound. But bump is something that you say in forums when you want
your
forum
shit to go to the top.
James, you're already at the top. There's nowhere to go. Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. And, you know, obviously we should say, and I hope I said this enough on the regular show, that there's a lot of speculation about this.
Sure.
You even see how we bring two very different stories to the table tonight. And the important thing is that there's a tremendous amount of debate and conflict and a need for evaluation of evidence and facts. And the questioning of, is this a fact? Does this story fit with or contradict an established historically, an established narrative? And those are opportunities that are all robbed from people in government school.
Well, I think our takeaway here, Brett, is that, you know, everyone's opinion is equally valid.